Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and always respectfully. It seems like there's a little pathway that we go down as we as individuals and as social groupings like the United States take in terms of climate change awareness. We start off with the science. What's going on in the physical world? It seems like that might be enough, that we see that human activities changing the climate in destructive kinds of ways, and we would take steps to manage that. But we don't, because politics rears its head, and political arguments, posturing, maneuvering for position take center stage over just a simple, okay, this is what the problem is, and let's fix it. And the politics just don't seem to work that great. And that takes us to human psychology. What is it about us as human beings that makes it so difficult for us to address this issue that is, from a scientific perspective, so very clear and that so clearly needs to be addressed? And I think true that throughout this hierarchy of thought is an underlying current of, okay, what is the right thing to do here? And that brings us to the subject of climate ethics. And today we're going to be talking to Dr. Brian Henning. He's a professor at Gonzaga University. He's deeply involved in studies related to the environment and to the ethical implications of how we address climate change. So let's listen in on that conversation. John Doherty here with Dr. Brian Henning from Gonzaga University. He's a professor of philosophy and environmental studies there. He's also the author of a number of books, including Writers on the Storm, Ethics in an Age of Climate Change. Dr. Henning, we're just delighted to have you here, and thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
It's my pleasure, John. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So let's have some fun here. So ethics, not something that, let's call them, lay people think about a lot, although I think we all probably have our ethical systems, whether we think about them or not. So how would you describe for a lay person what ethics actually is and what you as an ethicist do?
I think you're right that a lot of people don't think about it as much, in part because they think it's something that's really relevant to them when they've got a terrible quandary to face, that it seems like it's only in those most difficult moments when ethics becomes relevant. But actually, one of the reasons why Gonzaga has every student take a class in ethics is because we're of the view that it really has more to do with our fundamental value commitments and how they inform what we choose to do and how we choose to live our lives. So it's really something that we do every day, all the time. It's the values that inform our choices and our commitments. And so to focus it just a little bit, to give an example from my environmental ethics class, which all of our environmental studies majors and minors take, we would ask questions such as, what does something have to be like to be deserving of moral consideration for its own sake? Does it have to be human, or is it enough that it can suffer, or is it enough that it be alive? And if so, then what does it require of me once I figure out what matters, what deserves consideration and respect from me? And then once we probe those questions, then we focus on, okay, what is that, given those value commitments, then how ought you to live? Trying to shrink the gap between what we say we believe and what we do, because sometimes we say we believe things, but our actions tell another story. So it's about trying to then reflect on that interaction between what our values are and what we choose to do.
Yeah, I'm sure that that tension between what we think we should do and what we actually do is pretty familiar to most people, certainly familiar to me. Part of being a human being, I think, is to kind of struggle on that balance point between doing what we believe to be right and doing what kind of comes easily or something like that. A quick clarification for me. You used a phrase, something like how to live our lives. And I, as a layperson, would think of ethics in terms of making choices between right and wrong. Is there an overlap there, or am I a little bit off track here?
There is. Philosophers have for millennia been interested in trying to formulate principles that would help us to figure out, you know, what is right and what is not. But I tend to de-emphasize that a little bit. I think we can kind of get lost in trying to focus just on determining what is the right thing to do and fighting about it, instead of focusing on whether or not what our values are and whether we're in fact acting consistently with them. And so I tend to de-emphasize that part of it. Ethics becomes I think we tend to accidentally make it more into a version of the law, where it's about following certain rules rather than being a certain kind of person in the world. And so I try and move us away from this juridical. We have, especially in this country, a very much a juridical sort of a approach to these things, informed by both our political context and our religious context. I try and de-emphasize those things and emphasize instead the fact that it's a thread that is really informing all of our choices every day, all the time, and has to do about leading a fulfilling life amongst other valuable beings.
Yeah, that seems like an important distinction to me. One of the things I fairly often hear people in the public sphere, particularly politicians and maybe business leaders, they say something, well, we didn't do anything illegal. Like, that makes whatever they did was okay. So that seems like possibly that you're alluding to that kind of mindset a bit.
That's right. Legality and morality are frequently conflated. And so something could be legal but not moral, and vice versa. And so we really tend to have too reductionistic of a version of that. Are we not having done something wrong is too low of a bar. and especially we reduce that bar to what's legally permissible, right? And so that's we can do better than that.
Yeah, I would hope so. So I guess I personally would love to talk just philosophically generally all day long, but this is a climate program. So part of your CV is that you're involved with environmental studies at Gonzaga as well as philosophy. So how did it happen that you became interested in climate change? It seems like a bit of a jump from philosophy to climate change.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a wandering path. I finished my first book in 2005 called The Ethics of Creativity. And in that book, I was laying out a sort of an abstract ethical theory. And I was interested after finishing that to try and figure out maybe a moral dilemma to use as a challenge to apply that system to. And so then I thought, well, what's more thorny of an issue than climate change? And so I set about what academics do, right? You start researching and teaching about it. And I started teaching a class on ethics and climate change around 2007 and have been regularly teaching something like that for, since. And that my intention was to write another book where I was applying the former system to the ethical dilemmas related to climate change, but became so engrossed in the challenge and realized, as many people do when they start to sink into the science, that it's just so urgent. It felt a little bit self-indulgent to just write another book for a half dozen other philosophers who were going to read it. And so that's where this 2015 book that you mentioned earlier, The Writers in the Storm, Ethics in an Age of Climate Change, I wrote that for my class, just trying to summarize the basics of the science, the politics, economics, and then spending the last half of the book on the ethics. And so it felt like it was something that a philosopher could do to try and reflect how climate change is ultimately a question about our values as individuals and as a society, and that there are, I'm convinced, that in addition to it being a scientific problem and an economic and policy challenge, that ultimately it's an ethical problem having to do with what, as individuals and societies, we most value and want to become.
So, speaking of your book, then "Writers in the Storm," I'm just curious, where did that title come from?
I actually had a different title initially, and it ended up having to be dropped for various reasons. And so the publisher came up with this idea. And of course, the Doors fans will notice the title. I will admit with some humiliation, appropriate humiliation, I didn't notice it initially. And then I mentioned it to a friend and they're like, oh, you're a big Doors fan. I'm like, no. They changed one word so that we don't get sued. And so it's writers in the storm rather than on the storm. So far, the lawyers have not come knocking. So I guess the press was successful.
Yeah, so a couple quick things on that then. So the implication there is that climate change could be thought of to an extent in terms of a storm, at least a metaphorical storm, and we're all riders in that. There's no escape for us. I will just parenthetically comment here. I'm a child of the 60s pretty much, and I'm a Doors fan. I mean, I was listening to rock while they were making all those recordings, and I've actually went online here just before we talked and listened to Riders on the Storm by the Doors and just wanted to make sure. I was saying, did I remember that wrong? Was it actually Riders in the Storm? So that one vowel there just makes a little bit of difference.
Yeah.
So we're talking about ethics and climate change. So what are some of the ethical issues, maybe two or three or four, what you would think of as key ethical issues as we decide what we're going to do about the situation?
Yeah. So that's the big question that I'm liking to consider with you. And so one of the important immediate answers is that at the heart of anthropogenic climate change is this threefold injustice, that first, the people least responsible for climate change, who secondly have the fewest resources to adapt to it, are three, the going to suffer the most severe impacts, right? So we have this threefold injustice where the people who caused the least amount of the problem, they have the fewest resources with which to adapt and respond to it, are going to suffer and are suffering the most severe impacts. Although our country will and is experiencing the effects of climate change, the people who are in the mid-equatorial regions, sub-Saharan Africa, coastal regions, are going to suffer far, far more. And historically, if you look at historical emissions over the last century and a half, have contributed least to the problem. So that already is sort of a really severe problem that is at the center of international efforts to address climate change. It was at the center of the Kyoto Protocol. It's at the center of Paris. And we've, as a as international community, have never really done enough to fully allow our agreements to embody that. Or we're trying to do a better job, but there's not enough. So this injustice that's sort of at the heart of that, we'll notice that island nations, for example, as you know, are severely impacted. They're likely, some of them, to start disappearing as we get past a 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. Certainly, we're expected to lose several nations by 2 degrees, which was what we sort of aimed at in Paris. So one of the reassuring things, or not reassuring, one of the promising things is that increasingly the climate justice movement and the climate action movement is focusing on this more, that groups like 350.org and the Sunrise Movement, for example, are really embracing an intersectional climate justice approach to the work they're doing, both in terms of a just transition, where workers from fossil industries are transitioned and not left behind, but also centering indigenous and marginalized people in our conversations about the future that we're trying to create. And so I'm excited that it's moving it outside of the sphere of just simply being too much. It still feels like to too many people, it's just an environmental issue. I hope you know what I mean by that, where it's sort of, there's environmental issues and then there are human concern issues, where we sometimes categorize things. And the climate justice movement is trying to show how climate change is involving these forms of injustice that are part and parcel with other movements struggling for for justice. So that's the sort of that's one part of an answer. If it's okay, maybe I could go into a second part as well, if you're interested.
Well, absolutely, I'm interested. Let me just interject a quick question as far as we've gotten, and I'll trust you to get us back on track. So I'm very interested in human psychology, and in particular, the field of biases and so on, which are very impactful in terms of how we move ahead in addressing climate change. And one of the things that's very clear, and you're talking about this in a way, is that there are people who are unlike us, people who are far away from us, who are being more severely, will be more severely impacted, in many cases, far more severely impacted than we're going to be, yet we're one of the prime leading producers of fossil fuel emissions in the world. And when I look at that injustice, that inequity, and our lack of, really seeming lack of concern about it, let me give you an example from my own experience just about this concept. I'm a Vietnam vet, and so in the United States, when we talk about deaths in the Vietnam War, it's just, okay, how many servicemen and women did we lose there? And the reality is that there are somewhere probably over 1 million people died altogether in the war in Vietnam, but those are all kind of invisible to us. So I guess the summary of the question that I'm asking here is, while what you say is fundamentally clear, that people are being unjustly affected by our actions, it doesn't seem like we care that much.
It's a tough. In some ways, John, I really want to agree with you. So there's a sense in which a lot of our public discourse has been, we've been encouraged over of a generation to be increasingly selfish, I guess is one way of putting it, that we're encouraged increasingly, for example, to say, if this is not perceived to be in our narrow national self-interest, then it's not something that we should care about. We've been told that, and it's just become a truism for many people when that involves a potentially an immoral sort of decisions that have to be made that come out of that, as though, for example, people who are not American citizens don't then matter as much is partly what seems to be implied by that. Not saying that we need to involve ourselves in everything and anything, that we need to have some tests, but the idea that if you're not a citizen, you don't matter is something that is too common from politicians from both parties. That said, I don't actually think that most people believe it. I don't think that most people believe it. Most people, if they pause, realize that people are people, and that and not just people, but also other animals and organisms that suffer and are impacted. When I talk to friends, neighbors, and students, I find that people generally, when they pause and think about that, definitely have a reaction where they would say, of course. Those other people matter. So one of the long-term goals of my own is to try and bring these ethical considerations more to the surface and to make them part of conversations rather than just them being in the background and informing and sort of short-circuiting a lot of our conversations. I'm of the view that if we can bring them closer to the surface, and since they're affecting our decision making anyway, we might have better results. So right now it feels to me sometimes like all we look at, if we look at something, is maybe at the economics. We would say, can we do this? We would ask the economists, and then we would make policy judgments. And I would suggest, there's a nice quotation from the ethicist Dale Jamieson at NYU, who put it really well once. He said, economics can tell us how to achieve our ends efficiently, but not necessarily what our ends should be or whether we should be concerned to achieve them efficiently. So ethics is about what are our ends, where are our aims, where are we headed, where are we going? And once we know as individuals and as societies and as a species where we want to head, then we can design policies, technologies, and economies to achieve those good goals. But I think we too much fail to have explicit communal conversations about what really are our ultimate goals. And so to go back to your initial point of thrust of your question, fairness is a big part of how we arrange international climate agreements. The Kyoto Protocol involved a two-part scheme where, for the first phase, developed nations would reduce their emissions, and then developing nations would continue to have their economies grow, and they would meet, you know, there's this idea of contraction and convergence. They would converge at a certain point, and then in the second phase, everybody would begin lowering their emissions. And the time, the George Bush, W. Bush administration said that this was unfair because other nations like China and India didn't have to reduce their emissions. And so in the book, in the Ethics of Great, of the Writers in the Storm book, I look at different versions of fairness on a historical principle of fairness. If what we mean by fairness is historical emissions, well, we've contributed far more on a historical emissions basis. It's fair for the developing nations to reduce theirs more. What if we don't do a historical notion of fairness and we do instead a time slice where we say fairness is based on ability to help, capacity to help? Well, on that basis too, the developing nations have more capacity. And so I look at several different versions of fairness, and I couldn't find a single model of fairness where it wouldn't be appropriate that developed nations do more because they're more responsible and have a greater ability to do so. And they cause more of the problem. So the problem is that just doesn't get into the table with our political discourse, our political conversations. And so I think we should help it along and make that more central, since that's at the heart of really the heart of the issue.
Yeah, that seems like a really good point to me. It's almost like if we don't do that, we're forging ahead without any compass, really. We're on the march, but we don't have a clear picture of where we're headed, and shining a light on what would help us define our path in terms of fairness, which I think most Americans off the top of their head would say, yeah, I believe in fairness. I think it is part of our culture, but then it's easy to slip away in our policies and our behaviors if we don't keep shining a light on it.
That's exactly
so
right.
So I asked, we were on the question of some ethical issues related to climate change. I probably got us off track here a little bit, but else?
Yeah, I have two other aspects that I'd like to bring to the surface. So the first one, just to review, was this idea of this triple injustice of those who are least responsible, have fewest resources to respond, are going to suffer the most. A second thorny issue with regard to climate change and injustice is the problem of temporal extension. So climate change is significantly being driven anthropogenically by carbon dioxide emissions, and carbon stays in the atmosphere until some chemical or biological process removes it. And so on average, it's seen as having a life cycle of a century in the atmosphere, although some is removed very quickly and some not for a very long time. On average, the figure that's used is a century. That means that the pollution that we release today will continue warming the planet until 2120. And this creates a problem of what philosophers call an intergenerational justice problem, that it's not, again, just an environmental issue. It's this idea that we're making decisions today that will affect people for generations. And the climate change we're experiencing today is the result of several generations ago. And so this is a very our minds and our politics and our laws are not well designed to take into account long-term temporally extended phenomena. We, like every species, are really best at short term. We live in days and months, and we can, when economists talk about long-term forecasts, they're looking at like 6 to 12 months out. Yeah. And you know, geologists are looking at many tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of years, of, yeah. if not millions of years. And so there are these disconnects, and that involves an ethical problem in this regard, and since people today will make decisions that will continue to impact those for generations. And I have two young daughters, ages 15 and 17, and they've become active climate activists themselves. And it's remarkable to me how they don't focus on the fact that they didn't cause the problem. They're courageously trying to figure out how to create a sustainable and prosperous future for themselves and for those they love. And they would be right to, though, to be saying, like, I didn't cause this problem. I inherited this. And it's true. It's true, right? Most of these emissions were created before they were born. And so that's a second kind of ethical issue. And then, just to get it out on the table, I'm happy to head in the direction you want. But a third is related to the rest of the community of life on the planet. So I just edited a new volume through Rutledge called Climate Change Ethics in the Non-Human World. And it's a collection of essays examining the impact of climate change on non-human animals, plants, species, and ecosystems, and the moral urgency of addressing those impacts as well. In addition to being all too selfish people, we're also all too selfish as a species, and we tend to only be encouraged to sometimes only concern ourselves with whether something would impact humans. And I'm of the view that although humans are great, there are lots of other amazing forms of life on the planet as well, and that we have an obligation to consider those other non-human species and ecosystems when we're making decisions. So, for example, a species that goes extinct is gone, right? It's not coming back, and that's permanent. And there are all sorts of futures where we will have survived, we'll have adapted, but that nature will largely be gone. So, for example, I'm doing this talk with Humanities Washington Speakers Bureau, which is inspired by the Writers in the Storm book. And in that, I pose sort of a future question about what sort of future are we trying to create, and play with the idea of the Jetsons. You said you're a child of the 60s. I assume you remember the Jetsons, right?
Yeah, of course.
So the Jetsons is this Hanna-Barbera 1960s era technological utopia. It was supposed to be depicting the year 2000. And I think a lot of us, especially, here we are in Washington State, and we've got, you know, all these high tech, and I love a lot of what we're creating together. But I think we sometimes uncritically move into a future where we think that we're just trying to, all we need to do is figure out how to bring about the Jetsons. And if you picture back to the Jetsons, right, people are living up on these pedestals. Everything is in hermetically sealed bubbles. There's no access to nature, wilderness, running air and water, ocean, forest, mountains. We're just above the planet. And it's not clear what happened down below or what we did or why. But I'm not sure that it's a technological utopia. Or, you know, if you scratch the surface, and this is what I play with in the talk, if you scratch the surface of the Jetsons, I worry that you get something more like the animated Pixar movie WALL-E, where humans have consumed everything. There's no life left on the planet. We've had to go and live in spaceships out in space, and we've invented the technological means to sustainably meet all of our needs. But that's not a good future. So what worries me is there are futures that are sustainable but not good. And so a lot of what motivates me in these ethics talks is to try and get us to focus on that fact that we should at least be pursuing something which, if we were lucky enough to achieve it, would actually be good. There are futures where when we survive, but they're not necessarily good. And so that's a third kind of ethical issue that I try and bring to the surface.
Yeah, so I've got about half a dozen different directions that I'm dying to go on in here. So I'll just pick a couple. Just in terms of human beings and nature, this is possibly just a bit of an aside. There's a lot of good evidence that human beings who are regularly exposed to the natural environment, you know, trees and natural vegetation and flowing waters and things like that, that they are just happier, healthier people than people that live in an artificial environment. So I think, you know, the notion that we can be happy in a completely artificial environment is probably not true. It could be survivable, but
that's right. One of my colleagues uses a book called Last Child in the Woods, and they discuss the idea of nature deficit disorder. And a lot of our environmental studies students, it wouldn't surprise you, would agree with you that they're strongly of the view that we want and need to have connection with the extra human world in order to be fully human and flourishing. And so part of where I end the book is trying to encourage us to think about, is there a form of genuine human flourishing in within a genuinely flourishing natural world? Can we find our place within the biotic community as a member of it, rather than pretending that we're outside of it or trying to create an artificial world in which we are outside of it? And so that, I think, is a better goal, is how do we grow up as a species out of our sort of narcissistic species adolescence and become a member of the biotic community? What would that look like? What would if it's not the Jetsons and it's not sort of living in grass huts, what is that future? And that's, I think, what worth spending quite a bit of time thinking about as communities.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I think you've really answered this, but I just want to make sure I'm on the right track here. I'll draw a little bit of a parallel with, let's call them the hard scientists, the physicists, the chemists, and so on. Historically, they took a view something like, well, it's our job to describe the physical world, and then the rest of you folks can decide what to do with that data. And that view seems to be really coming into question in a lot of the scientific community. And they're starting to say, no, wait a minute, I think that we are going to have to go out there and make our research reliably accessible to the public and so on. And it sounds to me like that's an approach that you've taken on, that you're no longer content, if you ever were, to simply have academic discussions and debates within academia. You really want to reach out to the general public with what you, the issues that you want to bring up. Am I onto something here?
Yeah, that's right. I myself have become increasingly interested in what some of my colleagues call public philosophy. So this idea of these are inherently interesting and important topics that I think most humans, when they're given the time, find to be fun and important to think through together. So I've been doing the Humanities Washington Speakers Bureau in part, where I go to public libraries and churches and schools and give talks to ordinary folks, because these are interesting, important ideas that are too important to be left to, you know, amongst just academics. I'm not a scientist, obviously, but environmental studies is a really interesting discipline because it tries to bring together science, social science, and humanities, and our students take classes in each of those areas. And they're wonderfully prepared to try and live within that intersection of understanding the science. The science matters, the details, the facts matter, but they're not enough to then tell us what ought we to do. We need to understand the history and the politics and the religion and the ethics and the sociology and the psychology. All of these things are relevant to actually being able to address the problems that we've created for ourselves. And so these interdisciplinary programs like environmental studies are really exciting to me and very attractive to students, even though it's not necessarily the only thing they dislike about it is that it's not obvious exactly what job they would get immediately out of college. But I sometimes joke that they're exactly the students that the world needs. It's just that the world's not entirely sure what to do with them quite yet, right? that interdisciplinary education is important, and the engaging with the public is really worthwhile. I enjoy it. It's a really fun challenge.
Yeah, it seems like just listening to your points there that climate change is kind of forcing a rebirth of the Renaissance man, that our specialization can only take us so far, and we have to start making bridges between those various specializations. And so that seems to be part of the challenge, what you're taking on here.
That's right. Yeah, I'm working on a NOAA grant right now, and I'm a partner on a large grant. And yeah, they're encouraging me to do engagement and capacity building work as a philosopher with communities. And so there are still many scientists, and I have colleagues who fit this description, who themselves as scientists feel really uncomfortable with making any policy recommendations whatsoever, and are, I can't speak for them, but if I understand their position correctly, they're really worried that in an age where the politicization of everything, that the truth is no longer something we can take for granted, the idea that there is truth, they want to insulate science as much as possible, because they feel like if it also becomes tainted by the political process, that it will then also just be another position in the and amongst others, where they're all equals. There's just opinions. And I respect that. I can understand where they're coming from. I feel like our problems are just simply too urgent, though, to be satisfied with that. It just seems to, it would be nice if we had the luxury of just simply then doing our lab work and being good scientists, that we being like scientists doing this. I just, ultimately, I'm not persuaded by that argument. I understand it, but I'm not persuaded, because the problems seem to be too urgent. We need scientifically informed policymaking, and we need scientists to help explain it. I would love to see us have more work where scientists are trained to be science communicators to non-scientists, that would be part of what it is to be a scientist, is to learn how, and I think this is already starting to happen, but to make it part of what the self-understanding is, that that communicating with and explaining the possible policy implications of what you're discovering in your research.
Yeah, absolutely. It does seem to me that if science is just off doing science somewhere, I start asking myself, okay, well, why are you guys here? You know, it's like becoming a hobbyist somewhere rather than doing things that benefit us as a species. But
I think that's true, but I would have, just to disagree with that just only a little bit, is I wouldn't, though, want us to have to eliminate pure scientific endeavor or pure academic endeavor. There's a sense in which I would argue trying to learn is itself worth doing, trying to understand. So I remember this, I think it was a BBC broadcast about maybe the CERN the collider. And it was I think it was around when they were discovering the Higgs boson, and the scientists they were interviewing was saying, the interviewer was saying, well, what is the practical application of this? And he said, none whatsoever. We now know more about the way the universe works. And that's an okay answer too. It's just that if we can't just have that be the only answer that everybody is giving, I don't want to make it so that we have to say, because I'm a philosopher, and if you want to talk, you know, people are like, well, how is that practical? And I would say, well, practicality is a value, but it's only one of many, right? And so I can point to the practical benefits of studying philosophy, but I wouldn't want to reduce philosophy to its practical benefits, because I think inquiry for its own sake is also valuable. So I would just make that caveat.
Yep. Point well taken. So we are a few minutes left here. There's a couple of things that I want us to get to before we finish up. And you've made some allusions to our relationship with nature, which I think is an intriguing subject. As I've started digging into it for myself as an individual, I've realized that I really did come from a place like, okay, we're human beings, we're separate from all of this, however we want to use it, that's just really cool. And my own perspective is evolving, and probably not as evolved as yours or some others. So could you speak a bit about what you see as what's the proper relationship, if relationship is even the right word, between us and nature?
I think that should be the center of our focus, or it needs to be a very large segment of the conversation that we have over the next decades. I don't necessarily feel confident in saying I have a completely fleshed out answer, but I think that the fact that we don't sufficiently talk about that question is what I'm trying to draw attention to. So quick history, sort of context, starting about 400 years ago, in the Enlightenment, there was a set of philosophers coming out of the late Middle Ages, thinking of Thomas Hobbes and René Descartes, Francis Bacon, Isaac Newton, who thought that humans were the only thinking things in an otherwise clockwork universe. There was just simply stuff plus a mind in us, and that we were the only thinking thing in a completely vacuous universe. And that has that sort of what philosophers would call a dualism, that idea of a bifurcation between us and everything else, is fundamentally ingrained in all of our politics that came out of that period, all of our legal systems that came out of that period. It sort of pulled in the already longstanding Christian attitude that some had of humans being this imago Dei, that humans are uniquely made in God's image, that we're the only ones who then matter. And then it combined with sort of early what became science. And so we had this idea that we're the engineers of the planet. And Francis Bacon would say, you know, we need to torture nature to get her to give up her secrets so that we can make our lives better. And this is where that sort of practical applied science sort of stream came through. What Darwin just revealed unintentionally, sort of by implication, is that that's fundamentally false, right? That we're not the only thing that has thought, that has feeling, in an otherwise machine universe. That we are a product of evolution, not an exception, to it. That everything is a result of the same physical, chemical, biological, and ecological processes. And so that means that we're a part of nature, not apart from it. We've always been deluding ourselves into thinking that we were just separate from it. It turns out, once you say it, it's obvious that human societies only function if ecosystems are functioning. That they can't. We're a part of them intimately all the time. What I would hope that we could do as a species is to grow up into a mature species as a member of a wider community of life, that we could find a space. Most species that survive for a very long time are able to figure out a place within an organic community. And I think it's still possible to do that. One of my favorite figures is this man named Thomas Berry, who's a cultural historian, died maybe a decade ago. And Thomas Berry said that this project of figuring out what humans are, what are we as a species, and what are we in relationship to the wider natural world, is what he calls the great work, with a capital G and a capital W. The great work of our time is trying to redefine what we are as a species, because everything hinges on it. So he thinks we have the choice whether to bring about a lot of work has been done on the idea of the Anthropocene. I'm sure you're familiar with this idea of that.
Yes, of course.
So the Holocene over the last 12,000 years should have lasted many thousands of years more, but it's prematurely ending. And so geologists are deciding right now that we're probably entering a new geological period called the Anthropocene, which the Anthropos is the same root as anthropology is human. It's a Greek root for human, the age of human impact. Thomas Berry argues that we're not just at the end of the Holocene epoch. We're actually at the end of, he thinks, the Cenozoic era. And the Cenozoic era started 65 million years ago with the asteroid causing the end of the dinosaurs and making a space for our mammalian ancestors. And so he thinks that we're bringing about the Cenozoic, and we're choosing one of two different futures, either the Technozoic era or the Ecozoic era. And the Technozoic is sort of a continuation of our current trajectory, where we seek to use technology to dominate, control every feature of reality ever more fully. I don't know if you've done segments on geoengineering, but this always comes to my mind as an example.
Yeah, we have talked about geoengineering.
this idea, right? You sort of solar radiation management, for example, you turn the whole planet into an artifact. You try and control everything ever more aggressively, and that you end up with a Jetsons Wally like situation. That would be the technozoic. The ecozoic in Barry's mind is this idea of trying to find a place within nature. And it's not, to be clear, it's not a back to nature or an anti-technological model. It's rather making technology and economy as the means to an end, wherein the end is humans flourishing in a flourishing natural world. Where can we conceive of a form of human life wherein we're mutually beneficial to the rest of nature? And so I don't have a perfect answer of what that looks like, but I do think that's at least the right question to be asking. What would that look like? And to give an analogy, I think this is what's lacking in the environmental movement that is present in the civil rights movement, that Dr. King's dream is what I would argue is motivating people more than anything else. He was fighting against injustice and racism and segregation, but he was also fighting for a future where a little black boy and a little white girl can hold hands and in harmony, and where people are judged on the content of their character, not the color of their skin. And it's that beautiful dream that has been motivating people to literally fight and die to bring about a more just world. And I feel like too often that's lacking in the environmental community. We are clear we're against carbon pollution, and we're against extinction, and we're against habitat destruction. But we could do well to spend some time on saying, well, what is though the positive vision? Is it just simply late stage consumer society made sustainable? Is that as good as it gets? Is just simply figuring out how to keep the rat race of consumption going as long as possible? Because it's not clear to me that the people who win or lose in that equation are particularly happy. It doesn't seem especially fulfilling. So, yeah, I'm running on a little bit. Apologies. But I think that should be a part of our conversations that's lacking too often.
Yeah, agreed completely. One of the important things that I think I see in terms of the ecozoic, if I'm saying that term correctly, is it is going to require us as a species to make choices, because it seems pretty much history so far has been sort of free-flowing without people spending a lot of time talking and deciding about the consequences of what they're going to do. And I'm hopeful that we can turn to making thoughtful choices. And I think you make a really great point about I tend to find myself being gloomy about the future, and I struggle against that. And so one of the ways that I try to avoid that is to realize that we do have within our power to create a bright and happier future than what we're dealing with right now. So certainly get that.
I agree. I'm reading Ellen Kelsey's book, Hope Matters, right now, and I recommend it to your listeners as well. I'm about halfway through, but she makes a very persuasive case about the role of hope in this, a virtue with its sleeves rolled up, as David Orr once put it. So not wishing, not Pollyanna, but trying to create a better future is actually a great source of meaning and fulfillment, now.
Yep, so absolutely.
That it's not just do we fix it, it's also creating meaningful lives now. And the fight to do that is itself a great source of meaning. And so I found these conversations like the one we're having and that I have with people all over the state have been better and cheaper than any therapist. it's quite seriously. When you read the latest report, when you read that 2020 was tied with 2016 as the hottest year on record, when you see these storms, just yesterday we had 71 mile an hour winds in Spokane, 60,000 people are still without electricity today. These things are happening regularly now. I've only been here for 13 years, but it seems like, right, these are the things that are happening more and more regularly. We have these conversations too intermittently. And so I'm excited to have the opportunity to have them. We don't just want to reduce this down to a scientific technological problem, because if we do, we might accidentally end up creating a future which is survivable, but not good.
Well, I've really enjoyed our conversation. I've learned a lot. I appreciate in particular your interjecting the possibility of a bright future if we can talk to each other, if we can make rational decisions, if we can expand our consciousness as to what it means to be a human being. You never said that, but that's something that I'm personally taking away, whether it's right or not. But anyway, anything you'd like to toss in, Brian, as we finish up here?
Just one thing, and I'm not expert about this, but I do think it's worth making part of this conversation, is that when we have this discussion about what it would be to be living in a way that's mutually beneficial to the rest of the natural world, I think this is where indigenous traditions could really be useful. And I'm excited to see there's a resurgence and renaissance and interest in trying to learn from indigenous cultures, ways of living in their place and living well in their place. And I guess I say this is not an area of expertise for me, but I'm trying to start to read more in this area. So Robin Wall Kimmerer's book Braiding Sweetgrass is on my nightstand. I'm enjoying it. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. But she gives a lot of great examples of ways that indigenous cultures interacted with their place in a way that actually was mutually beneficial to those other forms of life, that the harvesting of sweetgrass in the way that they did, for example, was actually beneficial to the sweetgrass. And that those species evolved, co-evolved with those human communities in a way to benefit from the harvest and the interaction that they had. And so there are models, it seems to me, that are not romantic, sort of, again, back to nature sort of models, but rather, and this is what I love about Kimmerer, and she's herself a botanist. So she's got this Western education as well as being a member of a tribe, the Potawatomi Nation. So you get examples of what this would look like concretely. Like this is what we need is what would it look like to be actually mutually beneficial? And so I'm inspired to continue looking in that direction.
Yeah, I'm inspired with that too. Just a quick aside, I'm going to be teaching a continuing education course at Tacoma Community College spring. And one of our modules is going to be focused on indigenous wisdom as it comes to our relationship with nature. That was actually I'd said I had two things to talk about yet, and that was the second thing. So I appreciate you bringing it in. And we are out of time, Brian. Once again, I am deeply thankful for you to take the time with us. I've learned a lot. I'm feeling a little more inspired than I was before we started out. So thanks so much for taking the time with us.
Thanks for contacting me, John. I really enjoyed it. Best wishes. Great.
Okay, take care. So there you have it. One of the things I'm taking away is an inventory of my values and how I am applying them to my concerns for creating a happy and healthy and bright future for me, my family, and for all of us, really. You can contact me anytime, John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. Check out ccltacoma.org for program notes for today's interview. And in the meantime, as always, me reminding you to live like the mountain is out. Take care.